over my lifetime, assuming I don't get bumped off early.
Call the House Committee on Health Care to order for March 11, 2013. And I will tell you, if you're here, about House Bill 2902, we're carrying House Bill 2902 over to Wednesday. We'll be, we will likely be working on it on Wednesday. I'm going to begin by opening up a public hearing on House Bill 2216 and invite four folks to the, who know who they are, to the panel. It's our intention to hear this bill and then to pass it on to the Revenue Committee where it needs to be at the moment.
Actually, that's what I just
going to
load up. You're
going to start. I'll start. Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Colmer, Governor's Office.
No, I knew it.
Thanks for the opportunity to have us come up here and talk to you about 2216 today. I think this is a reflection of the work that's gone on over almost the last year or so to try to figure out how we can successfully fund the transformation efforts that you all helped pass in the last legislative session. As Ken and Greg will talk to you more about the process moving into this, I think that the governor was really committed in his budget to fully fund our federal agreement at the 4.4% and 3.4% per capita trend. In order to do that, we had to come together with stakeholders in order to do that with a diversified funding stream. And as part of that funding stream, you'll hear today a renewal of the hospital assessment for 2 years. And I'll let my colleagues talk a little bit more about that, and then Bruce can walk you through the details of the amendment in front of you. I think all in all, we've all been a part of the budget conversations over the last couple of years, and they've been contentious. Our goal was to come to you with a package that you could support, and I think this is a reflection of that. I think the co-chairs also acknowledged the great work of this group and other stakeholders to come to this agreement, because this is also reflected in the co-chair's budget as well. With that, I will pass it off to Greg and Ken to talk a little bit more about the process, and would urge your passage today of the dash twos, and I'll be here for any questions you might have. Thank you, Chair.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Ken Preventure. I am the President and CEO of Pacific Source Health Plans. I'm a member of the Oregon Health Leadership Council and co-chaired that group until December, and served on the work group that helped put together this proposal. I am pleased to appear today in support of House Bill 2216, which is part of a larger plan to make the Oregon Health Plan sustainable through the next biennium. The Leadership Council consists of 30 of the state's major healthcare leaders from health plans, health systems, and physician groups. We support the Governor Kitzhaber's budget to sustain the Oregon Health Plan, including the extension of the hospital assessment. The Leadership Council, by way of background, was formed in 2008 at the request of four business groups, the OBA, the OBC, the Associated Oregon Industries, and the Coalition of Healthcare Purchasers. And the group was charged basically with slowing the growth of healthcare costs and insurance premiums. 2 years ago, the governor approached the OHLC and asked us to extend our work, in his words, to bend the cost curve on Medicaid, which is critical, obviously, to retain coverage for lower-income Oregonians and avoid cost shifts to businesses and employees with private health insurance. Early in 2012, the OHLC collaborated with the Oregon Health Authority on a plan to fully fund the Oregon Health Plan for 2013 to 15, enabling the state's new CCOs to adequately get underway. The goal was to recommend a funding package to the governor that he could incorporate into his 2013 to 15 balanced budget. The package has a number of components, as you know, including an additional 1% of the hospital tax assessment to fund a hospital transformation and performance fund. The vision of the CCOs is to reduce the overall cost of providing health care while improving patient outcomes, as you well know. Much of those savings from the healthcare transformation will need to come from reduced utilization of hospital services and really reconfiguration of those services. As you know, hospital services comprise somewhere around 40% of the total budget. The Hospital Transformation and Performance Fund will assist Oregon hospitals and their staffs in the transitioning to delivery methods that significantly reduce overall hospital utilization while focusing on improving patient outcomes. It's important to recognize the on-the-ground realities that it will take to make these changes envisioned in the new form of healthcare delivery. Ensuring a level of stability for the CCOs and creating incentives to reinforce and expedite those changes makes business sense, and we encourage your support of this part of House Bill 2216. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Greg Van Pelt. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for Providence Health and Services in Oregon and also a member of the Oregon Health Leadership Council. Also here to share with you our strong support for the passage of House Bill 2216. A couple of things by way of example as Ken started. What we have done together as working with the state as well as within the industry, working with the March of Dimes, OHLC and 35 hospitals have agreed to stop elective delivery of babies prior to 39 weeks. This action has improved outcomes for moms and babies and had a significant impact on the number of babies requiring neonatal services. Five health plans, four state insurance purchasers, and 14 medical groups have deployed 23 registered nurses to manage the care of patients with complex chronic medical conditions. This two-year pilot project has reduced emergency room visits, hospital admissions, lab tests, prescriptions, and has improved patient satisfaction with their care. And then five health plans teamed up to reduce unnecessary high-cost imaging, which can lead to harmful radiation exposure. The cost savings so far exceed $9 million. As Ken mentioned, 2 years ago, Governor Kitzhaber asked us to engage in the effort to bend the cost curve. The OHLC, along with our hospital and physician colleagues and plan colleagues, over several months we worked with OHA and the governor's staff to develop the policy and budget concepts on which we could all agree, and based on numbers, we all understood. The end result is the OHB budget package that includes four components. Continued cost reduction from increasing the efficiency in the delivery of Medicaid services in Oregon. Overall, with everything still in this budget, the system must shed an additional $350 million in costs this biennium. We are committed to do that. Passage of an OHP budget funded at a level capped by the agreement with the federal government, including uses of general fund, tobacco taxes, and tobacco master settlement. Extension of rate-setting policy for non-participating providers and alternative dispute resolution provisions contained in Senate Bill 568. The Senate has unanimously passed Senate Bill 568, and we look forward to moving to the conversation on this important bill forward in this committee soon. House Bill 2216 contains two important components. A two-year extension of the current hospital provider assessment and an additional assessment of 1% to create the Hospital Transformation Performance Program that Ken referred to. The hospital provider assessment began, in fact, in 2004 as a temporary funding measure to offset impact of ballot measure 30 when 60,000 enrollees were cut from Oregon health plan standard. It has become an ongoing tax, and by 2009, tax on managed care organizations plans had ended, making the hospital provider tax the sole funding source for the entire expansion population covered by Oregon health plan standard. During the 2011 session, the use of the assessments were again expanded. The provider assessment continued to fund 100% of the cost of Oregon health plan standard population and for the first time provided partial funding for Oregon health plan plus the underlying statutorily required Medicaid program. These revenues were used to fund rate buybacks for physicians, hospitals, and durable medical equipment providers. House Bill 2216 will extend for two more years the hospital provider assessment on Oregon's 26 diagnosis-related group hospitals.
Mr. Van Pelt?
Yes.
Can I just comment? Just to make sure, the funds you're talking about weren't the hospital assessment funds. They were the federal funds that we got as a match.
That's correct.
Those funds went back into the hospital community.
That's correct. Yes. In fact, the current assessment is 4.32% of net revenue. And to your point, the hospital provider tax revenues are considered state funds and are thus matched by the federal government at approximately a 2-to-1 ratio. So from these proceeds, hospitals are reimbursed their $1 of underlying tax liability in the aggregate, and the remaining $2 is used to funding Oregon health plan programs. In 2011-13, the hospital provider assessment generated $650 million in state funds and $1.16 billion in matching federal funds. The Oregon health plan funding package would use the provider assessment generated as a result of HB 2216 to fund the majority of the Oregon Health Plan Plus population. The Affordable Care Act will fund the Oregon Health Plan standard population. The second important component of House Bill 2216 is the establishment of the Hospital Transformation Performance Program. As Ken mentioned, this program, funded with an additional 1% hospital provider assessment, is designed to help continue to drive health system transformation. The objective of the community, coordinated care organizations is to reduce the cost of health services and improve quality. One way of achieving this is to keep patients out of the hospital. With hospital volumes on the decline, this fund will assist all the Oregon community hospitals and their staff as we transition to delivery models intended to reduce significantly overall hospital utilization while focusing on improving patient outcomes. Hospitals have to show measurable improvement against several quality and patient safety goals to qualify for this additional funding. The performance pool requires no state dollars, and CCOs will benefit significantly from cost savings, but do not have to put any of their funding at risk. In the end, this creates a win-win for the state, CCOs, hospitals, and most importantly, the patients. Thank you for the opportunity to share with you our support as Oregon Health Leadership Council, as well as all the providers and hospitals in the state, in support of the OHP budget package and House Bill 2216.
Mr. Pell, I'd like to take a personal moment. You've announced your retirement from your position, and unless you find a way to stay involved in our health care system, it's going to be a great loss to the state. So please just don't go out fishing all the time. Stay involved in ways that
I heard that he was running for the legislature.
Where do you live?
Chairman's district.
Oh. I was afraid that was the answer. Yeah.
Thank you very much. That's very kind, and it has been a privilege and an honor to work with you, Representative Greenlick, and all of our colleagues, and have every intention to stay involved. Thank you.
Dr. Goldberg.
For the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. It's my privilege to walk you through the Dash 2 amendments that I believe you have that really put this in place. This amendment does four things. It renews the current hospital assessment for 2 years. It modifies the use of the assessment to be used not simply for hospital rates, but also for payment in the Oregon Health Plan, and not just for standard, but in now the plus population. It allows the use of the 1% performance pool, and it establishes an advisory committee to set the metrics about which that performance pool dollars will be used for. With that said, Section 1 establishes the advisory committee, which will have 4 members who represent hospitals, 3 with expertise in measuring health outcomes, 2 who represent coordinated care organizations. That's the group that will recommend 3 to 5 performance standards that are consistent with state and national quality standards. In Section 2, 3, sub A, and the rest of that whole Section 3, that does 2 things. It ends the current way that we use the current hospital assessment to go towards hospital rates, and it establishes a new mechanism for how we, in essence, can repay that tax in the aggregate. And that's being done primarily because at the federal level, there is some pressure to change how we do that. In section two sub six, that is where the current assessment is extended out through September 30th, 2015. Then in section three, this establishes how we would handle the circumstance in which the federal government were to change federal law around these hospital assessments. Currently, federal law allows the hospital assessment up to 6%. There's always been some concerns that the feds could change the ceiling on that down to 5 or 4 or 3 or 2%. And what that section does is just outline that the first to be eliminated would be the 1% performance pool, maintaining the dollars that go to the Oregon Health Plan as the next piece. Then there is some conforming language in section 7. Actually, section 9 lays out that the tax will no longer simply be used for Oregon Health Plan standard, but it allows the proceeds from the assessment to be used in the state's Medicaid and SCHIP programs. That section further goes on to discuss how there's the additional 1% will be used for the performance pool. And in section 13, directs the agency to get federal approval. And then section 14 makes this all operative when we get the federal approval. And that represents 6 months of a lot of hard work and great collaboration that went into this. And it seems rather dry and perfunctory, but a lot of good work that went into this.
Are there any questions of the panel? Thank you very much. You've heard no opposition to it. It's great when people lock arms and come in and tell us yay, yay. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2216 and open up a work session on 2216. Do I hear a motion on the dash two amendments?
You sure do.
Who's got that? Over there.
You have it?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash two amendments to House Bill 2216 dated 3/6/13.
Representative Thompson moves to amend Bill 2216 with the dash two amendments dated 3/6/13. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The dash two amendments are adopted. Do I hear a motion to move this bill on to the Revenue Committee or wherever?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2216 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue.
Representative Thompson moves HB 2216 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Revenue Committee by prior something or other.
Prior reference. Yeah. Whatever that word is.
Yeah. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Flynn?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Lightly?
Aye.
Representative Weidner?
Excused.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenland?
Aye. Motion passes and 2216 is on its way with the thanks of all with our thanks of all the folks who worked to make it happen, and let's hope it gets out of the Revenue Committee pretty rapidly. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2216 and open a work session on 2104. Can you tell us what that's about, Mr. Administrator?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2104 revises the definition of medical imaging to include medical imaging procedures not related to clinical diagnosis and treatment, prohibits persons from performing medical imaging procedure on another person unless the procedure serves a medical purpose and is ordered and interpreted by a licensed physician, nurse practitioner, or physician assistant acting within the scope of the licensee's authority, allows the Board of Medical Imaging to authorize by rule imaging procedures purposes related to research and education.
We heard a lot of hearing about that, a lot of testimony about that. All right, and I think we're ready to move it on. Do we have a motion on 2104?
We have a dash two amendment.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash two amendments dated 2/25/13 and the dash five amendments dated 3/8/13.
2/25, the dash two and the dash five.
Dash five dated 3/8/13.
Great.
To House Bill 2104.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves we adopt the dash two amendments dated 2/25/13 and the dash five amendments dated 3/8/13 to House Bill 2104. These are mostly technical and wording amendments. Is there any discussion on the amendments? Is there any objection? So moved. We have a motion to move the bill.
Sorry. Mr. Chair, I move that we pass House Bill 2104 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I would suggest this will go to the consent calendar if nobody has a problem with it. Is there any discussion on House Bill 2104 as amended? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Flynn?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Leitner?
Aye.
Representative Whitehair?
Excused.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenland?
Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 2104 as amended goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation and is put on the consent calendar. I'm going to open up House Bill 2522 for the purpose of amending it. And then I'm going to call a couple of witnesses to talk about the bill after it's amended. So can I have a motion on the dash one amendments to House Bill 2522?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash one amendments dated 3/1/13 to House Bill 2522.
The dash one amendments narrows the focus of the bill to dealing with making sure networks in the CCOs have available services for chiropractic, naturopathic, and nurse practitioners, and takes out some other language about the nature of that use and the financing of it. And we have an amendment on the floor. Representative Thompson moves the dash one amendments dated 3/1/13 to House Bill 2522. Is there any discussion on the amendments? Any objection? So moved. Can I call Dr. Goldberg and Dr. Sable to the... Dr. Goldberg, will you start?
Sure. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Goldberg, director of the Oregon Health Authority. Chair Greenlick had asked me to just provide you some background into how we currently handle contracting with and issues surrounding non-traditional health providers, chiropractors, naturopaths, pretty much doctors, nurses, everybody on the Oregon Health Plan. First and foremost is client choice. OHP clients can and do select alternative care providers on the Oregon Health Plan. CCOs are required to have an adequate network so that clients have an opportunity to choose those providers who they think are going to best impact their health. Having said that, we're always very clear that CCOs don't have to contract with every provider. That's not the case with doctors, hospitals, nurses, or anybody, but CCOs have the opportunity to evaluate providers, be certain that they meet their contractual standards, and contract with those who they feel will best meet both their network requirements for access as well as to meet their clients' needs. We've been communicating with CCOs about this for quite some time. Many of our CCOs do contract with and credential a variety of alternative care providers. There are also CCOs who provide services to their members through an array of alternative care providers, but don't necessarily credential or contract with them. And that's something that's commonly done by health plans with low-volume providers, where they may allow their members to see certain providers, but because it doesn't happen on a regular basis, they don't go through the formal process of administering a contract. And that's actually a benefit on both sides, but instead they pay the claims. We also have, as set out in Senate Bill 1509, a process, and it's codified in rule, by which any provider who feels they've been discriminated against can, based on simply who they are and their provider class, can make a formal complaint to the agency, and then we have a review process by which we review that. To date, we have had one provider that has brought a complaint to the agency about this, and we are working through that at this time.
So is your testimony that the bill as amended isn't necessary because OHA is taking care of the problem?
Correct.
Thank you. Dr. Sable.
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, Dr. Vern Sable representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association. Our intent of this additional language was to better define what network adequacy is. That's part of what is looked at by the Oregon Health Authority when there's an aggrieved, when there's a provider that's aggrieved that feels like they have not been properly handled by the CCO. And so our language is only to make that clear, that there is adequate numbers of all provider types where possible so that there are not undue waiting periods or other restrictions for CCO member patients to get to that provider type. There's a perfect example of this in Albany in a what's called Heart Springs Clinic, which is kind of a holistic clinic, wherein in a Samaritan Healthcare that has put together their CCO, where they have medical physicians, they have an osteopathic physician, they have an acupuncturist, they don't have a chiropractic physician yet, but they are in such small numbers, but such high demand, it takes 2 to 3 months to get. I've had patients say it took them 3 months to get into see a alternative care provider, such as the acupuncturist. So we just wanted to ensure that the CCOs do not feel they are they are following Oregon law and the non-discrimination provisions by having a token number of whatever provider type. The hope was just to make it clearer and to keep the possibility of aggrieved providers to a minimum.
And you have a sense that language in the bill provides that, and the bill is currently written?
That's correct. Correct.
Did you point out that language for us? You
have the language appears. Let me find it.
Okay.
on page 3, section 2, subsection 1, lines 40 through 43. Enrollees and members have reasonable access without significant waiting periods or other restrictions to all types of providers and all services under the contract, including reasonable access to chiropractic physicians, naturopathic physicians, and nurse practitioners. The next four lines are deleted. That's the dash one amendments.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, you have a comment on that? Is it?
Chair Green, the members of the committee, I haven't seen the amendment, but I mean, my comment would be based on that language that's currently what we do is provide a standard of reasonableness around access and client choice.
Are there any questions to the folks?
Yeah. Bruce, we've been going through this for a long time. What is your concept of network adequacy? I mean, is 6 weeks reasonable to wait, 2 weeks, 2 months, 9 years? And I realize that's going to vary geographically because I don't have a psychiatrist in my district. The wait's going to be very long to get that appointment. But that's part of what's going through my mind is I don't want a patient to be told, and Dr. Sable may have made an adequate reference to the Albany situation, but if we're telling patients that they have access to these people, but in fact they don't have because it's so far out, they died before they got there, then it's not adequacy, but I don't know the answer either. What are you thinking?
Chair Greenlake, Rep. Thompson, members of the committee. I think what you're getting at is that we use our judgment based on the circumstances around what's reasonable. There are certain things, such as emergency care, where it's reasonable that be provided urgently within hours. There's other more elective care where it might take longer. It's often, I think, difficult to come with an exact number. I think part of that, as you indicated, is not just based on the urgency or elective nature of a problem, but is also based upon what could be reasonably provided. If something doesn't exist in with enough capacity, it may be weeks or even more than a month to get a service. So I think the department tries to balance out the type of complaint, the supply of providers, and apply what is some sort of a reasonable standard that hopefully we can defend.
Follow up from here.
Sure. Would that be an appealable situation if somebody felt that there were adequate providers, but they weren't being engaged or the waits were too long? Is that something you'd look at on appeal? Or?
Chair Greenlake, Rep. Thompson, that would certainly be something we would look at, and we would look at if there were many more providers in the area that felt that there wasn't access, and that the reason for that was indeed that providers were being discriminated against for some reason. Yes, that is something we would look at. But again, I guess the one thing I would like to point out is that we tend to look at this from the standpoint of the client and not from the provider. That, you know, the access is about the ability for clients to get care. It isn't for providers of services to have a contract.
So, Dr. Goldberg, I just have a couple of questions around that comment. So, again, you talked about it being client choice, but the CCOs are only a contract with a certain number, and I appreciate that. And so one of the numbers they may not be contracting with is who this client may want to go to, but they might even pay that. I'm trying to understand the timing and all that if the person needs services in that, and yet you got to go through this process. They're not contracted with, but that's who they need to go to and prefer to. How long does all of that take?
Correct. Chair Greenlake, Rep. Lively, members of the committee, let me clarify client choice. It means providing a choice, not necessarily the client's choice.
Okay.
And that is for a variety of reasons that have to do with quality of care, provider being able to meet certain standards that the plan has. But we are required by federal Medicaid law to offer what's a reasonable choice, but not what is an individual's choice.
So, Conger? Oh, I'm sorry. You still follow?
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up. So just so I clearly understand this. So again, so they're offered choice. So within, whether they be a chiropractor or naturopath, they're part of services that they could receive, and they're on the list so they could go to those. So in those cases, the reimbursement to those services and so on is already set within what governs the CCOs in that. So from a cost standpoint, I'm just trying to understand the differences, the variance in cost.
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Lively, members of the committee, it's up to the CCOs to figure out how much they're paying for services. Have the flexibility to do that. And again, this discussion really is not any different than any other type of provider, that it's incumbent on CCOs in the state to offer a choice, whether that be a doctor, a nurse practitioner, et cetera. But health plans and the state maintain a certain network through which to provide that choice.
Okay.
And then clients can indeed appeal if they feel they're not having their needs met, and we certainly consider those.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Conger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions related. And each of them are based in the language in the bill. So the first is on page 2 at the very end, and it just adds, so this is paragraph K, subpart E, and it says that members have the OHA will adopt rules so that members have a choice of providers within the coordinated care organization's network, and the providers participating in a coordinated care organization include, and it said, include providers of specialty care originally, and the new language adds licensed acupuncturist, licensed massage therapist, licensed optometrist, and other, then it goes on, providers of specialty care. Now, I'm going to switch to page 3, but keep in mind that this part calls out massage therapists, acupuncturists, and optometrists. And then on page 3, this is in section 2 of the bill. It says a CCO, and I'm summarizing because there's a lot of other language in here, a CCO must maintain a network of providers from each healthcare profession requiring a license or certification in this state, sufficient in numbers and geographically distributed to ensure that enrollees and members have, and I'm not sure what the difference between an enrollee and a member is, that's a sort of a sub-question, but have reasonable access without significant waiting periods or other restrictions to all types of providers and all services under the contract. And then it calls out chiropractic physicians, naturopathic physicians, and certified nurse practitioners for all primary care services.
Oh, it ends now at practitioners.
Oh, I'm sorry. It ends at, oh, that's right. That was another part of the dash ones, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So ends at certified nurse practitioners. So there's a requirement that CCOs maintain a network of providers from each licensed or certified healthcare profession. This is a question for either of you, if you can answer it. First part is, how many licensed or certified healthcare professions are there in the state of Oregon? Subpart to that is, does every CCO have within its service area boundaries, if that's an accurate description, all of those professions? Third question is, why are we calling out in one section chiropractic physicians, naturopathic physicians, and certified nurse practitioners, and up above we're calling out acupuncturists, massage therapists, and I forgot the third, and I don't want to flip back. So actually had three parts to that question.
I'll answer that. Chair Greenlick, Representative Conger, members of the committee. The reason why the optometrists, optometric physicians, and the others are kind of, and the acupuncturists and so forth, is because, and later reference to chiropractic, naturopathic physicians, and nurse practitioners, is the capacity to provide primary care services. The other optometrists, acupuncturists, and massage therapists do not act in the capacity of primary care provider. So there's why that separation was. As far as the numbers of all health care providers, I have no idea. And I think it would be very plausible, if not probable, if there are going to be some CCOs, especially in far eastern Oregon, that are not going to have all provider types within their network. And then, of course, they're not going to be in violation of something they can't provide because there's not that provider type in their geographic area.
Well, that's not what the language says, Dr. Szabo. I just want to be clear. It says must maintain a network of providers from each healthcare profession requiring a license or certification in this state. May I follow up, Mr. Chair? I'm sorry.
Yeah, rather briefly, we don't have the paperwork on this, so we're not going to work it today anyway.
Thank you. I didn't realize that. I had some concerns. But briefly, I'll just also point out that the amendment took the reference to primary care out. So I'm not sure if the language now that calls out chiropractic, naturopathic physicians and certified nurse practitioners is relevant to primary care if we deleted the reference in when we added the dash ones to the bill. Anyway, I'll relent with that.
Briefly?
Okay, briefly, I have a question too. I know we're not working it, but just want clarification before. So on payment, on section 4, line 32 and 33, this section does not prevent an organization from establishing varying reimbursement rates based on quality or performance measures. That particular piece was backed up in a legislative council opinion that was sent to, I think, our committee, saying, in addition, Section 4, Chapter 80, Oregon Laws 2012, also prohibits a CCO from varying reimbursement rates based on factors other than quality or performance measures.
This doesn't change the law.
So that would appear to keep the law as it is. But in page 3, Section 2, line 45, it seems to me to say something different, and I want to really just understand this.
That's all been deleted.
Oh, that's the part that's deleted.
Amendment.
Okay.
Deleted.
Okay, thank you both very much. We'll take it under advisement, think about it. But as of now, the work session on 2522 is closed. I'm going to open a work session for an unusual purpose. I'm going to open a hearing or a work session?
A public hearing.
A public hearing on House Bill 2065. The opponents of us have asked us not to hear it yet, but I had promised some folks that they would have 15 minutes to talk to us about a possible amendment to the bill if the bill comes up for a work session, a possible stuff or gotten stuff to the bill if the bill comes up for a work session. So I will ask them to join us and be brief. I think we have some people that want to testify against, but I think they want to testify against the bill, and that's not what we're talking about. So if you'll just bring people to talk about that amendment, that's all we'll open up the hearing for, if that works. And you have 15 minutes, or less would be even better. Jim, are you starting us?
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Bunn. I am representing Advantage Dental, but I'm also here as a parent, and I'm going to show a 30-second video. I took my son to the dentist on Friday, and for his cavity, we used silver nitrate. And if you watch the video, again, it's just 30 seconds, the first brush that you see is silver nitrate. The second is fluoride varnish. first requires a dentist, the second can be done by a hygienist.
Did you pay equity rates for your son on this?
So
you pay equity rates for that act there?
It's not acting.
That was it. 30 seconds. That tooth was treated, and my son was a happy camper.
Chair Gingrich, members of the committee, I'm Mike Shercliff. I'm a dentist and the president and CEO of Advantage Dental. I want to thank you for the opportunity to present before you today, and I appreciate Chair Gingrich, your opportunity. You're giving us the opportunity to do this because I know it was a little unusual, and we appreciate that. Advantage Dental is the largest IPA owned by over 325 dentists located throughout Oregon. I want to take this opportunity to thank you to discuss this very important talk concerning medical management of caries. Caries is a process that causes cavities in teeth and is a result of a bacterial infection. I'm here today because the Board of Dentistry rules process did not work and it appears to have gotten caught up in the scope of dentistry issue disguised as a safety issue. In your hands, you have a chart, laid-out chart, that shows oral health from birth to death. It shows the right evidence-based science and technology applied at the right time by the appropriate provider that, if done, would very likely result in every Oregonian having a cavity-free mouth. The medical management of caries is a part of this continuum where a person develops a cavity. The cavity can be arrested without a filling and helps stop the caries process. Part of medical management of caries is using silver nitrate and fluoride varnish. The Board of Dentistry has rules that only a dentist can apply silver nitrate. This amendment would allow it to be applied by appropriately trained dental hygienists and assistants. This is not a safety issue because it is already okay for the dentist to apply. The reason silver nitrate works is because of the silver, which is a well-known antimicrobial agent. Silver is used in bandages and wounds. Most of your soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq have their bones impregnated, or their wounds impregnated with silver. Keeps the infection down. It is a lot of your surgical drugs that you see your hospital folks running around if they're impregnated with silver. There's a plethora of literature around silver and its safety. In your hands, you have a couple of photos of my grandson, Joseph, whose parents, by the way, reside and represent Congress District.
Wise people.
Joseph has a genetic disorder called 1P36 deletion factor syndrome, similar to cerebral palsy. He has a muscle control problem. These kids usually die of aspiration pneumonia because they're not able to swallow properly. They rarely get to their teens. They are now having a chance at life because of a little button. Sorry about that. Personal. It's a little button device you see on Joseph's stomach. See a little button on there? That's how they feed him, as he can't swallow. He almost died 3 times in his first 12 months because he couldn't swallow. They rarely get out of their teens. They now are having a chance of life because the little button device you see on Joseph's stomach allows him to be fed. Joseph, until he was choked 3 times, they figured out what his genetic disorder was. Joseph got this feeding device when he was around 1 year. Interestingly enough, the way they keep this device from getting infected is applying silver nitrate around the button device from time to time. My point is that silver, the safety of silver is well known. Silver nitrate allows the same thing in teeth. The cavity and disease can be arrested and prevented so the child can grow older and have the filling done somewhere other than the hospital under general anesthetic. No local anesthetic is needed. Studies at the Mayo Clinic have shown that general anesthetic can lead to learning disabilities in some children. Granted, silver nitrate needs to be handled appropriately, just as any many other materials used in dentistry applied by dental assistants and hygienists. In the new world of triple aim, better care, better health, better cost, provided in the global budget, a new paradigm of oral health is needed. Caries is a chronic disease that needs to be looked at differently. rather than how many cavities are filled, we need to see a cavity and a subsequent filling as a failed outcome. Advantage, since it's implemented this carriage protocol, has reduced its hospital referrals in its network for treating cavities by almost 25%. It has reduced its specialty referral by over 26%. In its company clinics, it has reduced its hospital referrals by 50%. These savings approach $1 million a year. In close, you will find a quote from Don Berwick, the father of the triple aim. He says that the solution to the triple aim are not tactical, but rather political. In my opinion, what is going on by the Board of Dentistry is not about science, but about politics, so we brought this issue to you. I never imagined the Board of Dentistry, remember this in my opinion, I never imagined the Board of Dentistry would not have a public hearing on this issue. I suspect issues like this will come to you time and again, in fact they just did, as resistance to change raises its head trying to hang on to the status quo. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I forgot to mention the explanation why this is before you. The relating clause was appropriate, and based upon the timing, the Dash 1 amendments were submitted and brought before you, and we took no position on the underlying bill.
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Ironside. I reside in Portland, and I'm a registered dental hygienist and the Government Relations Council Chair of the Oregon Dental Hygienists Association. Silver nitrate to control dental caries has been used for over 100 years. It was so commonly used that silver nitrate came to be known as Howe's solution after Dr. Percy Howe, American Dental Association President and founder of the world's preeminent dental research center, Forsyth Institute of Boston, in Boston. The placement of silver nitrate onto a cavity is analogous to a nurse placing iodine on a cut. In the current epidemic of dental caries, we need to use all options that have safe, effective, and are affordable. We need to empower dental hygienists working in collaboration with dentists to provide this vital public health service for those citizens with little access to care. Thank you.
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, I'm Stephen Duffin. I'm a dentist. I live in Wilsonville, Oregon. I joined the Capital Dental Care in 1994 when the Oregon Health Plan was just beginning. Stayed with that company as the Oregon Health Plan rolled out, and we tried to develop a dental network here in Oregon up until 2005 when I retired as CEO and dental director of that company. The reason I retired is because in spite of my efforts and the efforts of my colleagues, many of us here, dental disease was getting worse. In spite of everything we're doing, the Oregon Smile Survey, for instance, shows dramatically increasing caries rates in those people that are most at risk for it. So why is this going on? I was frustrated, so I left and I went back into private practice. The main reason was so that I could focus all of my energies on revisiting what is going on with this disease and why can't we control it, especially because we seem to know how to prevent it. So I assigned a group of Medicaid children to my practice in Shoreview and Kaiser, Oregon, and I went to work, looking at the problem straight in the face, looking for new solutions. I found that more fluoride varnish and more sealants were just not cutting it. And so I went back in the history of dentistry, and I started over. I said, what were they doing 100 years ago? What were the first dentists doing? I literally read books 100 years old, and I found that G.V. Black, the founder of the modern dental profession, in 1908, was using silver nitrate to arrest cavities. He described the protocol precisely. I modified that protocol slightly in my practice. I added fluoride varnish to it, and what I saw was a miracle. I saw children able to come into my practice and receive care to stop the infection in their teeth, not just receive more fillings, which, by the way, doesn't work, but to cure their infection. I saw them, the number of hospital cases dropped dramatically, my ability to see more children in the same time, in the same facility to go up. It was a remarkable experience to see that happen in my practice. This experience has been documented in the article that you have, which was published in the November issue of the California Dental Association, describes that process. I've had the privilege over more than the past year of acting as a consultant with Advantage Dental to teach this protocol within their network of providers here in Oregon. We've seen thousands and thousands of people treated successfully with this protocol, which is safe, effective, and affordable, and has a 100-year history of that being used here in America. The simple fact that it is not used commonly is not an excuse that it doesn't need to be done now, because we have an epidemic of disease. We need everything on the table that we can possibly get. Those that are opposing this approach to care simply are doing so because of ignorance or because of personal financial interests. Thank you very much for giving me your testimony today.
Thank you very much. There's some folks that have signed up in opposition both to the underlying bill and to the Dash 1 amendments, but we'll save those until the bill, when and if the bill comes before us.
Thank you
very much. Thank you very much for your testimony. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2065 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2858. Will you tell us what that bill is about, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2858 appropriates money to the Oregon Department of Administrative Services for a deposit in the Primary Health Care Loan Forgiveness Program Fund and declares an emergency effective on its passage.
And let's see. We have, who do we have? Doug Barber, Ben Rodriguez, Lisa Dodson, and at the first panel and after that, Bob Demick and Paige Hatcher. In a few minutes, will need to step away. If I do, it won't be because of anything you said. And well, if you'll take over for me when I go, I should be away 15 minutes. If we finish with this hearing, we can move on to the next one as well. So.
Thank you. Representative Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm Doug Barber, here today on behalf of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians in support of House Bill 2858. We did not expect to be back before this committee on this issue this session. Many of you who were on the committee in 2011 will remember the loan forgiveness bill that we brought before you at that time, that you passed, that went to Ways and Means. It was funded, the program was created, and is working. We expected that the funding for that would be in, the program is now set up at the Office of Rural Health at OHSU, and we expected the funding would be in their budget for this upcoming biennium. In a quirk in the budgeting process, I'm told that OHSU put that line item in their budget, then either DAS or BAM told them they had to take it out of their budget because there was nothing in the legislative intent to indicate that this was meant to be an ongoing program. Well, so we are here today to make it as clear as we can possibly make it that the whole purpose of the loan forgiveness program is to create an ongoing pipeline of medical professionals, physicians, nurse practitioners, who are willing and ready and committed to working in rural Oregon. For physicians in particular, these awards are ideally made, you know, after in the end of their first or second year of medical school. So they have 2 or 3 years of medical school yet to go, plus 3 or 4 years of a residency program before they will come back to Oregon to fulfill their commitment. So this is not a short-term strategy. This is not a one-year fix. But over time, if you have 6 or 8 students each year making this commitment, once those commitments start coming due, you will have a steady stream of skilled, highly motivated providers coming into rural Oregon. It's a great grow-your-own strategy that we think will strengthen healthcare in rural Oregon and we strongly recommend and ask for your support on House Bill 2858. Thank you.
Representative Greenleck and members of the committee, my name is Glenn Rodriguez. I'm the Chief of Graduate Medical Education at Providence Health and Services and Director of the Oregon Family Medicine, Providence Oregon Family Medicine Residency Program, and past President of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians. And first want to say thank you for your past support of the package of bills we really brought in 2009 to support primary care, strong primary care foundation and workforce into the future. And I really appreciate that support. And what's really exciting about the Loan Forgiveness Program, after this panel, you get to see the folks really in that program, some of our best and brightest students, and you can see what this really creates for a future of rural healthcare in Oregon. So my job is to be quiet and to shut up and let you talk to them. But I did want to just highlight one other issue, because we've been in an ongoing conversation about really what it takes to build and maintain a strong primary care foundation in the state since 2009. And the one piece of the puzzle that I'm sure you'll be hearing more about, we're not directly addressing today, is graduate medical education. That's the residency program years after students graduate, before they are eligible to be licensed as a physician and board certified in their specialty of choice. And by 2015, nationally, we will have increased our medical student graduation rate to exceed the supply of residency slots nationally by 2015. So there will be graduates from allopathic and osteopathic schools in the United States who won't be able to get residency programs. And in Oregon, that's even more dramatic because we're increasing the number of students so dramatically with very minimal increase in residency slots. I am proud to say that our program is starting a rural family medicine residency track in Hood River. Our first folks will be entering this summer. So we'll have two folks doing their continuity family medicine training in Hood River, Oregon, beginning this summer. So we're excited about that expansion. But with that, I'll let Lisa talk about the specifics of the Loan Forgiveness Program and what it's accomplished.
Thank you, Chairman Greenleck and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Dodson, and I'm here speaking as the Secretary of the Board of the Board of Directors of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians and a former rural physician myself. The indebtedness acquired by our students during their training programs is reaching crisis proportions. The current level of indebtedness threatens the social mission of our medical education system, undermines our health care reform efforts, and is counter to the increasing need for the robust primary care workforce needed to control medical costs and ensure access for all Oregonians. As you will see from the examples provided at the end of my testimony, which you should have received, there are some examples that I will refer to in a moment showing this as a very real problem for our students. The students do not need to graduate debt-free in order to enter primary care disciplines, but they must have a mechanism by which they can reduce their debt levels to reasonable levels that allow them to make these choices. This program is complementary to other state and federal loan repayment programs and other proposed and existing programs. If you look at the back page of my handout, you will see an example of a medical student graduating with $250,000 of debt, which is not out of the range of normal at this point, a 7.9% interest rate, which is the current rate for PLUS loans that the medical students receive, and no loan forgiveness program. On that, there's a 10-year, 20-year, and 30-year payback schedule. You will notice at the bottom of each of those is the annual income required to support the loan. There is no example with this level of debt at that loan forgiveness rate that any family physician can achieve that. The average starting salary for a family physician in the country right now is $160,000, and even with a 30-year payback option, paying back almost $500,000 in interest, the annual income required to support that loan is $218,000, or nearly $50,000, more than $50,000 above the typical starting salary for a family physician. The second example gives you an example of a student with the same level of debt, the same interest rate, but 3 years of a $35,000 loan forgiveness program, reducing their total debt to $145,000. And you can see on those payback examples that the income required to support that loan payment will occur at a 20-year payback and 30-year payback option. Even at a 10-year payback option with that level of loan support does not achieve the income required to support that loan payment. You will hear from our students in a few moments about their experience with this, but I just would like you to be aware of kind of we have really reached a crisis actual point where students cannot meet their loan obligations and go into primary care, particularly in rural areas. Thank you.
Any questions of this panel?
Doug, are you satisfied that we have the language in here right so this isn't another annual program? It was my recollection that that was not the intention, and I think if you look back at legislative intent, it's probably pretty clear there, but somebody apparently didn't find it.
Well, I went back and forth with legislative counsel on that, and when I actually gave them the legislative concept for this bill, I tried to write language in to make that clear, and legislative counsel says, well, we don't put that kind of language in appropriation bills. You just have to get it on the record. And he said, in fact, the bill from last time and the law, it's clear in that law that this was meant to be an ongoing program, because if it was going to sunset, it would say it was going to sunset.
Right.
And the fact that there was no cutoff date means it was meant to be an ongoing program. So, fight between lawyers, I guess.
It just strikes me as strange that we would take that kind of a position. I mean, how are we going to help a handful of students for 1 year and then the problem goes away? I mean, you know,
yeah. We wish.
Solved.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, I think, at least now we know that there's this potential issue out there. I think we'll work closely with OHSU in their budgeting process, and that there's a potential red flag, and if anything pops up again, we would know to watch out for it.
Okay, thank you.
And they will know to watch out for it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have Bob Demick and Paige Hatch and Sarah Williams.
I distinctly remember those discussions.
Demick, you're not going to try and pass yourself off as a student, right?
Don't have a mic on. My state isn't worth much, but it was there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Dimmig with the Oregon Office of Rural Health. We're the ones that administer this particular program. A lot of the history was already given in the previous testimony, but I just wanted to add that the students who apply must be enrolled in or intend to enroll in a qualified rural-specific Oregon training program. Our office does define that to some degree, and I also wanted to remind the committee that in addition to attending a qualified rural training program, awardees must agree to the following: 1 year of clinical service in an approved rural Oregon practice site is required for the forgiveness of each year of loans granted through this program. Service shall begin no later than 90 days following the completion of a primary residency physician assistant or nurse practitioner training program. They must provide a minimum of 32 hours per week of clinical practice in an approved rural Oregon site, and eligible practice sites will be located in rural federally designated HPCSs, MUAs, or areas of unmet health care need as designated by the Oregon Office of Rural Health. During the first year of the loan forgiveness program, loans were awarded to 5 students, 4 medical students, and 1 doctor of nursing. We do have a couple of those students leaving, and it is the intent of several others to reapply. And the next round of applications is due April 1st of 2013. 2058 would provide the funds necessary for our office to continue to administer the program, and it would fund an estimated 14 loans of approximately $35,000 each over the period of 2 to 3 years. Again, it has necessary overhead in it, and I appreciate all your time and will answer any questions that you'd like.
Thank you.
And show you my freshman ID.
Here we go. Okay. So I've been before you before, so hopefully you remember. If you don't, that's okay. My name's Paige. Thank you for hearing my testimony today. I am a family physician completing...
Please introduce yourself.
Sorry, my name is Paige Hatcher. I'm a family physician completing my preventive medicine residency at OHSU. So I already did family medicine, graduated board certified from the OHSU program, and I'm doing a second residency in preventive medicine. I've also finished my MPH in June at Portland State, and I graduate in October from my preventive medicine residency. So I'm talking to you today because I'm a loan forgiveness recipient. I have committed to the state program in Kansas, where I went to medical school. When I was considering education after college, I thought medical school was out of my reach. My family is average, but we're only one generation away from poverty, and I had paid for college myself because my parents were still paying off their own student debt. Even at my state school, medical school tuition was much more than I could afford, especially considering that I had no interest in lucrative specialty practice. I was sure I wanted to go into rural primary care. So the insurance of debt relief made it possible for me to pursue rural family medicine and public health. I have loved my time in Oregon. It's bittersweet that I will be moving home, but I've learned immensely from experts here, but I'm very excited to return to my home state and establish a rural practice. In October, I will be returning to a small town in Kansas, it's called Marion, where I will practice full-scope family medicine in a rural access hospital and its associated clinic. I also plan to teach and continue my research in health services delivery. I was able to find exactly the kind of job I've always wanted to do because my debt has been forgiven as part of this program. I didn't have to worry about the large student loan payments when I set up my first practice, and that gave me considerable freedom to consider employment that satisfies my career and personal requirements instead of financial concerns. The only requirement is that I practice primary care in an underserved county, of which there were 100 out of 105 in Kansas. I owe the state 5 years of service, and in turn, my entire debt will be forgiven. The program in Kansas is very robust. In my entering medical school class, 30 spots were funded by the program, and they are every year. Not all of them actually fill, and the leftover dollars are allocated towards loan repayment. In addition, every year, a few students don't fulfill their commitment, usually because they have chosen a non-primary care field. I, for example, have loved Oregon, but if I decided to stay here, I would have to pay back the state of Kansas approximately $360,000 as of this month, because interest will have accrued at 15% since I started the first day of medical school. So if I was going to be a neurosurgeon, this probably wouldn't be that big of a deal, but because I'm not going to be, there's no way that I can afford, which will surely be almost $500,000 by the time I'm done with the accruing interest. So the program in Kansas has been in existence for decades and has served the state well. The majority of the primary care physicians in Kansas have actually participated in the program, many of whom have actually moved out of state and came and relocated to Kansas because they knew about the program. So I'm happy to answer any questions you have about the Kansas program, but mostly I hope to offer my encouragement that your support of HB 2858 is a wise investment. Thank you.
Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Sarah Williams, and I'm a fourth-year medical student at OHSU, and I'm speaking to you as a recipient of the Loan Forgiveness Program. 2 years ago, I testified for loan repayment and loan forgiveness, and now I can happily say that I received the primary care loan list this year as my last year of medical school, and after residency, I will owe a year of practice in rural Oregon, and as a very influential year, I'm sure it will set me up nicely for a career in rural Oregon, and I'm very much looking forward to working and practicing here, and I really appreciate the mutual commitment that we can make to each other, as seeing that this is a commitment here, and I want this program to keep going and have students in the future be able to do this as well. When I tell my peers about this opportunity, they're proud of me. They're happy that their advancements in primary care in our state, and I think it gives impetus to students going into primary care. As you know, the loans are daunting. Are daunting, and my situation is very similar to what Dr. Dodson described as $250,000 in debt, and my husband is also in medical school, so we have doubled the loans. So this is very important to me, and I welcome any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being here.
Is there anyone else on this bill? Okay, I will close the session on that bill and open public hearing on the Senate Concurrent Resolution 1. Tara, would you like to read what is it up? I guess I don't like that, huh?
Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, Concurrent Resolution 1 supports adoption of a state plan for Alzheimer's disease and related dementias in Oregon.
Okay, so John Bartholomew, Maria Kane, and Jim Davis. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Vice Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the House Committee on Health Care. My name, for the record, is John Bartholomew. I am the Public Policy Director for the Alzheimer's Association Oregon Chapter.
A lot of lone people going
on. I see Jim's waiting in the wings here. Didn't want to be rude to Jim. So. Thanks.
Thank you.
So our mission is to eliminate Alzheimer's disease through the advancement of research to provide and enhance care and support for all people affected, including caregivers, and to reduce the risk of dementia through the promotion of brain health. We provide education and support for people diagnosed, their families, and caregivers all throughout the state through our 800 number and from our offices in Portland and Eugene. I served as the staff on the task force that created the state plan for Alzheimer's disease, and I'm really glad to say that the process for creating it has already led to greater collaboration between stakeholders than existed before the process began. The process was very collaborative along the way. The co-chairs were one person from the public sector, Jennifer Mead from DHS, and a person from the private sector, Jason Hess, the CEO of Elite Care. And we had folks from state and county agencies, nonprofits besides myself. We had Alzheimer's Network and AARP Oregon, researchers and educators, nurses, doctors, social workers, elder law experts, and of course, people who have been impacted personally by Alzheimer's in their family. We've also been thankful to have the involvement of Senator Mona Sanderson and Representative Dembro as members of this task force. So the stakeholders came together over 2 years ago to craft a plan to address Alzheimer's needs. The initial group formed five work groups to focus on five areas: public education and awareness, legal and financial issues, continuum of care, medical and research issues, and public safety. In addition to having the expertise of these work groups, we did six town hall meetings around the state and a telephone town hall meeting so that people in rural areas from Brookings to Pendleton could participate as well. And so hundreds of people participated in that. We developed an online survey as well to get feedback that hundreds more participated in. And once we got that input, the work groups crafted 10 recommendations, and then we vetted these recommendations through dozens of other stakeholders in Oregon to get feedback. So I want to go quickly through what is in the state plan and let you know what's going on. We crafted this in a way to make sure that it was doable. You know, there's not a lot in here that costs money. Not a lot of it, there's a lot of it that doesn't require government involvement in any way, shape, or form. It all involves collaboration between many different stakeholders. And there has been some issues, like where we recommend spending money on something, we took pains to identify how we expect it to save money down the road as well. So the first goal is to enhance public awareness and engagement. Two recommendations are to do a public awareness campaign. And right now we are working with PR experts to determine how much that would cost, what it would look like, and then we're going to go ahead and try to find foundation funding for this. Number two, develop a one-stop shop website for Alzheimer's related issues. We heard from members of the public that there's a lot of misinformation out there. They don't necessarily know where to turn, whether they should go to the ADRCs or the Alzheimer's Association. This would be a one-stop shop that people could figure that out and go to the right place. And we're waiting to hear back on a request for funding from DOJ, actually, for this website. Goal two is to optimize care quality and efficiency. Obviously, we're looking at the triple aim as one of the goals of this plan, too. So we want to develop and implement quality standards and metrics for dementia care in all settings where people with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia may be living or being treated. A work group has formed, chaired by Terry Harvath at OHSU and staffed by Jan Carlin at DHS. So that's moving forward. We also need to ensure that Oregon has a dementia-capable, licensed healthcare workforce. It's going to be part of the goals of a new work group formed by the Governor's Commission on Senior Services in collaboration with the Oregon Disabilities Commission and other organizations. And I'll be co-chairing that group, so if you've got input on that, you can come to me. Goal three is to protect individuals with dementia. First part of that is to create a guardian training program. We heard that there are guardians who are family members who don't know much about being a guardian, and we have guardians who are professionals who don't know much about being Alzheimer's. Making sure that there is training for all of these people. And this should dovetail with the efforts that we also support to create a public guardian program in this state. The next recommendation is kind of a three-parter, just expanding the capacity to protect the safety and well-being of individuals with dementia and their families. Transportation. The Governor's Commission has created a work group on transportation issues and dementia, but just generally for the senior transportation issues. And we're expecting a report from the Oregon Association of Counties on transportation and seniors soon. So that's in the works. There's a work group on Medicaid withdrawal, the situation where a long-term care community might say, we're not doing Medicaid contracts anymore, and how that impacts the people. So there's a work group that's formed on that. And the gatekeeper program is something that is to expand the gatekeeper program statewide. Gatekeeper trains people like meter readers and grocery store clerks and bank tellers what to look out for vulnerable seniors and others, and then who to report it to. Really simple program, saves lives, saves money down the road. This is in the governor's recommended budget, and I believe, I have to double check, but from first reading, it's in the co-chair's budget as well, to expand it statewide. It's been operating in Multnomah County for 25 years, and it's been a fantastic program. Improving access to quality care. There is a group focused on dealing with the people with significant behavioral issues who end up at the state hospital because of those behavioral issues associated with dementia. There's a work group staffed by Jan Carlin, chaired by Linda Crandall, who's an expert in these issues. There is funding to develop a program for this in the governor's recommended budget, but it should easily be offset by savings at the state hospital because it's an expensive way to treat people and it's not the most effective setting for these folks. Furthermore, OHSU is working to expand telemedicine options so that we have more expertise delivered to the rural parts of the state. We're already working on better data as well. The Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, if you guys are familiar with that, well, we are now collecting data through that on caregiving, the health impact on caregiving, as well as how many people in the state have cognitive impairment. And lastly, we want to promote research here in Oregon. And there's one thing everybody in this room can do if they haven't already done their taxes this year. The Alzheimer's tax checkoff is on the form this year, and we encourage people to check that, put part of their refund towards research that stays in the state of Oregon. And there is a more robust promotion of that going on this year and will be in the future. So there's a lot going on in this plan, and it'll take a lot to work to make sure that all the goals are met. There's a lot of things that need to happen with Alzheimer's that we can't do at the state level, but now there's a national Alzheimer's plan as well, which just came into being. But my point to leave you with is that Alzheimer's can't wait. There's over 76,000 Oregonians living with this disease today, and we expect that to go up to over 110,000 by 2025. That's right now about the population of Bend. And it is like adding an entire county down the road here in the next 12 years. And we got to remember the caregivers. There's over 165,000 unpaid family caregivers in this state, providing over $2.2 billion worth of unpaid care. We need to help these families, and this plan will.
your support on SCR1 will help send a strong message to Oregon that our elected officials understand that we need to act and that this plan is a good beginning. So thank you, and turn it over to Maria.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Geyer and members of the House Committee on Health Care, my name is Maria Kane, and I'm the daughter of Bill Whitney, who was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease on February 6, 2012. I have also worked in the healthcare industry for 35 years, mostly with people who have different forms of dementia. Growing up, I lived on the same street as my grandmother, who had dementia, and I shared a very special relationship with her. In my early jobs as a CNA in nursing homes, I understood that our residents were grandmas and grandpas, and I eagerly embraced the opportunity to know them each as individuals. Today, I'm honored to be with all of you and to share my excitement on both the professional and personal levels about the statewide plan. On a professional level, as an educator, geriatric care manager, powerful tools master trainer and class leader, Alzheimer's support group facilitator, behavior coach, STAR-C consultant, I get great gratification from connecting with people with Alzheimer's disease and their families to help them find their own new lives of thriving and hope. One of my STAR-C clients came to the program feeling very worn out and, in her words, feeble. Her chief complaint was that her husband no longer recognized her. He would argue with her and insist on leaving the house to go out and look for his wife. At one point, she even had to call the police for his safety. As you can imagine, this was very upsetting for her and for her whole family. Through the STAR-C program, she learned that she could try new approaches. First of all, to help him feel more secure and less likely to become anxious and thus looking for his wife, she built a reliable routine for him based on activities that he enjoyed. Secondly, she learned that if he did become anxious and start looking for his wife, she could help him look for his wife, get him involved with something. If she left the room for a minute and then came back and gave him a big kiss, he would know, it would help him know who she was, and then he would relax. That was about 2 years ago, and they're still successfully living at home together. On a personal level, and this one is a little harder to discuss, as you can imagine, it's a little painful for me to watch my own father, who has Alzheimer's disease, with his deterioration. But on a personal level, however, I really appreciate the difference that it has made in my father's life to be able to connect with the resources that help him find a new and exciting life in which he can thrive. His hope is that all people in Oregon who are losing their memory would find their way to a life that focuses on all the strengths that they still do have. By doing this, people with dementia and their loved ones can thrive and enjoy their lives. My dad, Bill Whitney, has done this by connecting with the Alzheimer's Association and by working with physicians and other specialists who understand Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. My dad, who gave up driving after driving his car through his garage, finds the Tri-Lift program very helpful as a way to get around. Where does he go, you might wonder? He will gladly tell you that he enjoys his art classes most of all. These are the Memories in the Making program offered by the Alzheimer's Association. He also gets a lot of help and encouragement from the Alzheimer's Association's support groups. He also works with with specialists, including his geriatrician, a physical therapist, and a speech therapist. Through the support group and the art classes, he has made friends who enjoy him and appreciate him for all that he still brings to these relationships, including his compassion and his creativity. And they do not focus on what he doesn't bring, which is memory. My mother, who is a primary caregiver for my father, says that she's always considered herself a compassionate person. But since working through the STAR-C process herself, she now realizes that she is compassionate when the person's behavior makes sense in her reality. She has learned to stop saying, "Bill," and to meet my dad where he is in his reality and to meet his needs in ways that reduce his depression, anxiety, and frustrating behaviors. My mother is looking forward to attending the Powerful Tools classes where she will learn 36 tools for caring for herself. This is especially important given that the statistics are alarming for the healthy caregiver predeceasing their loved ones with dementia. Currently in Oregon, while services exist for people with dementia, these programs are not available in all areas, nor is there a clear method for helping people find the programs who need them. Often people find the resources by chance. Therefore, I fully support the statewide Alzheimer's plan and wholeheartedly look forward to watching the plan positively impact the lives of people with dementia and their families. My father, Bill Whitney, would tell you that he used to live in fear, and now he lives in hope. The statewide Alzheimer's plan promises that many others like him will live in hope as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hello, Madam Vice Chair and members of the committee. I'm Jim Davis, here today primarily to represent the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, but I would be remiss if I didn't also mention my other groups that are strongly in support of the Alzheimer's State Plan, the Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, United Seniors of Oregon, the Oregon Alliance for Retired Americans, and the Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities. We all have strongly supported SCR 1 and its recognition of the plight of Alzheimer's disease. And we also strongly support the State Alzheimer's Plan. This is really a perfect time to develop a plan around Alzheimer's disease, and the Alzheimer's Association has done a great job, and John has been amazing. So we just are so supportive of where this is heading and the tremendous impact that it's going to have. As John had intimated, dementia is going to increase exponentially through the years as the boomers pile into their senior years. And the most recent data estimates that by 2050, the population with dementia will triple, which is just shocking beyond belief. The burden that it will cause to family caregivers and a very ill-prepared social service system that even now isn't adequately meeting the needs of people with Alzheimer's, and we can only imagine when that figure triples what's going to happen. A few quick points I want to make. We, of course, always support increased Alzheimer's research. By stalling the onset of Alzheimer's, you'll save tens of millions of dollars, if you want to look at it that way, which can seem a little insensitive. But the fact is, not only will it help the families and support families, but in a policy way, it will save millions. But there's such a need for Alzheimer's-specific services. And the trained workforce you mentioned was an incredible idea. But we also need programs that are specific to people with Alzheimer's that understand how to reach out to that population. And there just simply aren't enough of them right now. And I want to see us go beyond just Medicaid-related programs. I want us to see that the other 90% of people with dementia have access to services that provide them support, and also that family caregivers are given much stronger support within the community. As a geropsychologist and a psych professor, I would be remiss if I didn't mention how important it is to support the mental health needs of people with Alzheimer's. You have to understand that Alzheimer's in and of itself is a brain disease and is not a mental illness. But the fact is, as any of us would probably experience, that once you come into dementia and you realize where this is heading, very, very high rates of depression and anxiety and fear. And I think we need to be able to respond better to that through counseling and therapy. Group therapy works real well in these populations, but also individual therapy to help them to deal with it. So that's very important. And I might mention that we just finished the work of the work group group, and Representative Kenemer was on that work group. We just finished the work of the work group on senior and disability, mental health and addictions through the Senate Health Care Committee. And one of the areas we looked at very specifically was the relationship with people with dementia and how we can provide better support. We also looked at the Gatekeeper program, and Gatekeeper networks are so important to involve the community in ways that can support people with dementia and help in their survival, and you know, if there are problems that arise, they at least know how to respond.
Jim?
Yes, please.
You can keep talking or we can pass your bill.
Oh, well, that's a deal. but anyway, thank you for giving me the opportunity to provide support for this measure. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Briefly.
Yeah, just I think it's more in the nature of a comment. I'm still reeling from a phone call from my sister Tuesday night, and she's identified as second stage Alzheimer's disease. So, you know, it's kind of something when you see it hit close by. And and years ago, I remember my grandmother was, you know, in those days, we didn't know what to say. But
we don't know what to say yet.
And we don't know what to take. Yeah, that's a good point.
I will close the public hearing on SCR1 and open a work session on SCR1. Do I have a motion?
You do. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Concurrent Resolution 1 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Committee Geyer moves SCR1 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll. Excused. Absent.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
You want to carry?
Representative Widener?
I'd love to.
Excused.
Vice Chair Kitty Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenwood?
Aye. Motion passes. President Kenemer?
Okay, thank you.
Carry the bill on the floor.
Thank you very much.
Guys, good job.
Thanks a lot.
Close the work session on SCR1. Open a work session on House Bill 2858. Do we have a motion on House Bill 2858?
We have a motion. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2858 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Thompson moves House Bill 2858 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Tam?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Excused.
Vice Chair Kitty Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2858 moves to the Ways and Means Committee. I close the public hearing and we're adjourned. About the other one.